This episode is brought to you by Ursa Minor Outfitters. Folks, I'm absolutely in love with my Loon mug. It's handmade. It's an absolute piece of art. Whether it's at the office or at the house, people keep asking to check it out. If you're not a Loon fan, they also have other beautiful mugs for wildlife fans of moose, bears, and eagles. They specialize in products highlighting the outdoors and local pride through quality design by local artists. They've even started expanding into items beyond mugs, like apparel, dog accessories, and soon candles and more. They also try to partner and highlight other small businesses, and in some cases, forgo profits in lieu of charitable giving to help their community, such as the dog rescue. So check them out, ursaminoroutfitters.com, and enter promo code HIKESMIKES10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. And for our four-legged hiking partners, they also have a portable silicone dog bowl and also a sweet over-the-collar dog bandana. Go check them out, ursaminoroutfitters.com, and don't forget to enter promo code HIKESMIKES10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. Welcome everyone to the Hikes and Mikes podcast. I'm your host Ivan, and together we'll embark on a weekly journey connecting with extraordinary hikers from all corners of the U.S. and beyond. Throughout these spring months, we've had the privilege of conversing with remarkable individuals. Their experiences and adventures will leave you yearning to hit the trails. In this week's episode, we're heading to Montana and the Bob Marshall Wilderness to talk to the co-authors of Hush of the Land, A Lifetime in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, Arnold or Smoke Elser, and Eva Maria Maggi. You can follow them on Instagram at Hush of the Land. Smoke and Eva share their favorite memories from venturing into the Bob Marshall Wilderness on horseback, their unique story on how they met, and Smoke also describes how advocating for Montana's wilderness shaped his guiding, teaching, and conservation roles. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode with our guest, Smoke Elser and Eva Maria Maggi. Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Hikes and Mikes podcast. I'm really excited to be speaking with these individuals today. They are the authors of Hush of the Land, A Lifetime in the Bob Marshall Wilderness. I'm here with Smoke and Eva, who are going to be joining us and speaking about this wonderful book and their outdoor experiences. Thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast. We always like to start off by just asking the guests to kind of share a little bit about themselves and their outdoor experiences.
Yeah, hello, I'm Eva. And I love to be outside. I have actually started out as a hiker, so I hike quite a bit, also with a backpack. But I really love to ride a horse wherever I can, and in particular here in the Bob Marshall Wilderness in Montana. So I like to spend my summers in the Bob Marshall. I take my family. I have two kids, 11 and 8, and my husband got the bug too. So we're all riding around the Bob Marshall. But I also, yes, I said, I love hiking. I'm originally from Germany, so that's where I kind of started my hiking career and my riding career, and hiked in Scotland and Iceland and Italy, Poland, kind of all over Europe. And then I also did a little bit, of course, over here in the United States.
I'm Smoke Elser, and I came from Ohio, of all places, from the Steel City near Youngstown, Ohio. But I came out here when I graduated out of high school. I said, I don't want any more of this back here. I want to head out west. So I headed west and I got to Montana. I loved Montana. I got a job with the Forest Service, was a lookout looking out for fires. And then as that kind of closed up, but I went ahead and stacked brush for the Forest Service. And then I met another outfitter called Tom Edwards and his friend or his cousin, Howard Copenhaver. And they brought me into the horse packing. While I was with the Forest Service, I learned from Cloyce Mann, and he taught me a lot about horses and how to handle horses in the hills. So I worked 7 years for the Whitetail Ranch and packed into the Bob Marshall many, many times. I've spent over 55 years in there. My grandkids once totaled up all the nights I slept in a sleeping bag on the ground, and it figured out to 22 years. So I've been all over the Bob Marshall, and I love the Bob Marshall, but I love any wilderness area. They're all good to me. And I've traveled all over the country. I've gone to the Gila in New Mexico, and I've gone to the Grand Canyon, and I've gone to Yellowstone Park, Glacier Park, and I enjoy all of those areas very much. And I ride on a horse. So I sit 5 feet above everybody, so that I can see what I'm looking at and I don't have to watch my shoes where they're landing because the horse does the driving for me. And I think that's a good system. But every time I meet a backpacker on the trail, I try to step off so that I'm not looking down on somebody, but I'm looking right directly at them. And I like to talk to people eyeball to eyeball so that I can explain what we're doing here, why I have all these mules and horses with me, and where I'm going, and some of the better places in the Bob Marshall for hikers to visit, as well as horsemen to visit.
And I got to ask you, Smoke, because lately in the last two seasons, we've had a couple guests from Ohio, and from their description, it has really become a hidden gem for outdoor experiences. Outside of the national park, there's some great local state parks. How would you describe growing up in Ohio and, you know, that shift from the Ohio outdoor scene to then Montana?
Yeah, I was in the Boy Scouts back in Ohio, and I went to Camp McKinley. And I spent a lot of time there all summers, matter of fact, at Camp McKinley, either working there as a errand boy or as a counselor. And I like that real well. There are a lot of good wilderness areas in Ohio, but they're not as big as the Bob Marshall. When I get on a horse in the Bob Marshall, I can ride for about 3 or 4 days and never see another road, never see another building or anything. So I kind of like the Bob Marshall.
I feel like two places in the continental United States that really have a large wilderness area that people can just go and explore for days, if not weeks, and that's Montana and Wyoming.
Yes.
Now, Eva, I did read something interesting about you, and I wanted to ask you about it. You spent some time here in the Pacific Northwest. Did you get a chance to enjoy some of the outdoor opportunities that Washington State has to offer?
Oh, absolutely. I think I probably hiked one of my favorite trails out on the whole river, out in the Olympic Peninsula. I enjoyed that very much. I love the beach and the forest together. It's just a unique and very charming and magical combination. No, I've spent a ton of time outside. I tried to hike as much as I could in the Northern Cascades and wherever I could go. I was pretty busy. I was in graduate school, so I didn't have a ton of time. But when I had it, I was always outside. So I really, really liked it, really enjoyed it.
Right on. And you guys have a very unique story of how you guys kind of came together. Can you share a little bit about that origin story and how it helped develop this amazing book that you guys just released?
Yeah, sure. So I moved to Montana in 2017. And before I even signed, I think, my contract to work here at the university to teach, I signed up for Smoke's packing class. I was involved with the Backcountry Horseman organization for actually 5 or 6 years before I met Smoke. And he was one of the co-founders of the organization here in Missoula. But what we do is we go out, we clear trail, and we just go because we have the horses much further and farther than other people. And I love that work, but I also wanted to spend even longer time outside. So I wanted to learn how to pack a mule and a horse with all my camp gear. And I signed up for Smoke's class, and it happened to be in my neighborhood. I just live up the hill here. We're sitting right now in the old stone barn, exactly in the room where we met for the first time. It's his office. It's beautiful. It has a lot of old equipment and pictures. And it's just a beautiful room that just makes you curious about learning more. And I was sitting in here and at the first day of class, and Smoke started telling about horse packing in the Bob Marshall and about his stories that he, his adventures that he had over the years. And I was just mesmerized, and I knew that I had to record his stories. And so that's how it started.
And I'm glad you mentioned that you recorded those stories, because that's an interesting way to develop this book. Because from what I've read, it was hundreds, if not thousands of hours of you guys just having conversations that kind of morphed into this book. How did you go about choosing recording those conversations and then turning it into the book?
Yeah, so I didn't really think about doing a book at all. For me, it was just so mesmerizing hearing Smoke tell his story. I just think he's the best storyteller I've ever met. And it's not only the story itself, it's the way he tells it and his voice and how it carries. It's really this tradition of oral history, you know, that has mesmerized humans forever. And it was just so magical that I knew I had to record it first. It could also be that I just am very comfortable with recording because I've done it for my PhD work a lot. I did a lot of interviews, and I think that is just something that came to me naturally. But I just knew we needed to conserve these stories in their form, in their how they're told, like really in their oral history. So that was important important to me. And then it became kind of handy to have for the book, of course, because once we came up with the idea of like putting that into a book and having those stories transcribed, it made it a little easier to put them together and use them as the foundation for the book.
And early on in life, Smoke, and you've kind of touched base on this, you decided to forgo a career in forestry and become an outfitter. Can you tell us more about how that decision came about?
Yeah, I was in the forestry school here at the university the first 2 years of my college. But on about the third year, I met this Tom Edwards and Howard Copney. We were at the end of the trail, and they were leading a bunch of mules and horses out of the hills and brought a bunch of guests out. And that convinced me that I wanted to kind of be a packer or an outfitter instead. And at first, you know, you don't make much money, but you sure have a lot of fun. You meet some of the best people in the world. People that like the outdoors, people that like wilderness are all good, period.
I agree. You know, you've had some amazing experiences, primarily in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, but also the Bitterroot Mountains. Can you share a few of some memorable experiences in both of those regions during your time as a packer that
sure.
kind of stick out for you?
Yeah, I can do that. And I'm an outfitter, not just a packer, because an outfitter supplies everything for the people except their sleeping bags and personal gear. And he also takes care of them so that they can't get in trouble and get in a landslide or anything like that. That's part of our job. But in the Bob Marshall, a lot of our trips were about 120 miles to 150 miles in length, and they were done in 8 days. And we had a lot of good guests, and I've traveled all over the Bob Marshall, the east side, the west side. And I started, of course, in the north end, up near Glacier Park, and then moved to the southern end where I lived, which was a lot easier for me to haul stock. But all over the country, in the Bitterroot, that was a major hunting area, and I loved to hunt down there because we had a camp right along the Idaho border. And the Idaho hunting season would open about 2 weeks before we went hunting, and it worked out very well because they moved the game right over to us. But the Bitterroot hunting camp was great. It was near Overwitch Falls on Overwitch Creek. It proved to be a very good area, and we always got snow there. I like to track in snow, and we had lots of good experiences. I have one that my guest shot an elk way out on an end of a ridge about 2 miles, 3 miles from the camp. So I grabbed a couple of mules, and he and I went out there and went way out to the elk, and I quartered it. And by the time we finished quartering it and loading it onto the mules, yeah, boy, it was getting pretty dark and starting to snow real heavy. Came back along the ridge, and on the one side of the ridge, that is on the northeast, on the north side of the ridge, it's almost a cliff that drops right down into Overwitch Creek. And as I traveled along, all of a sudden, I noticed that the snow was getting a little deeper. And I said, hey, we're headed north. We're not headed in the right direction. So I turned around and we came back a little ways so that I could backtrack a little ways. And then I hit where I could tell that the snow was getting lighter. So we headed on that way and managed to get to camp without any problem and unloaded the elk there and had supper. That was a good trip. But I've had lots of those good trips in the Bob Marshall as well as in the Bitterroot. The Bitterroot Mountains are a unique range, and enjoy hunting there as well as taking summer trips in there. I've done both.
Let me tell you, Smoke, reading your guys' book has definitely elevated Bob Marshall Wilderness and the Bitterroot Mountains on my bucket list. I've been to Montana, but only to Glacier National Park, and then I had some friends and family in Cutbank, Montana. So that's kind of the region I was able to explore, but the way you guys describe the Bob Marshall Wilderness, it just sounds like an amazing place for not just hikers, but anybody that loves the outdoors.
It certainly is.
Yeah, we agree.
Now, Eva, you've had a chance to explore the Bob Marshall Wilderness a lot as well. Are there any memorable experiences that stick out for you personally?
Yeah, I take my kids and my family, but also a university class actually every summer. It's going to be our fourth year this summer. And I think the most memorable time for me is when I have these students, undergraduate students mainly, but also some graduate students, and some of them never been on a horse. Actually, most of them never been. And, you know, they're kind of scared that where we go in, it's on the North Fork of the Blackfoot River, and it kind of starts out pretty stark. There's a big scree field that you have to cross, and it's a pretty steep drop off down to the river. And it starts right from the beginning. So you have to really kind of let go of your ego and trust that horse 100%. And obviously the horse doesn't want to die either. So they're just fine. But it's hard for the students. They really have to let go of that. And I think especially today where we have so much technology and we try to control our lives in so many different ways, it's a big ask. And it's beautiful to see when it happens. It's scary for them and they have to do it because they're already on the trail. There's no way to turn around there. And once they get over their own ego and kind of let go and really trust that horse, you can see that relationship grow and they kind of turn back into kids. And so when we're in camp, they really start running around and giggling and laughing and being all excited. And they don't even have to take care of their own food, right? I mean, the food that what outfitters do, they bring their food in and we have an outfitter who does that for us. And it is obviously super luxurious, but it's also amazing because often they don't eat very regularly. And so having actually food there every evening and you have your lunch and your breakfast does something to you. It kind of gives you a comfort and a safety and security out there in the outdoors. And they really start enjoying themselves. And I love that. Like I really love to see that transformation. And that happens over multiple days. For some people, it takes really 4 or 5 days. And the last day, we usually ride out in like 22 miles in a day. And that's for somebody who has never been on a horse, very painful. Can be anyway, but everybody's happy. Like I have not had a single person who didn't enjoy it and wasn't proud of themselves. And I would like to say that kind of changes people's lives. And I'm grateful for them to take the chance to do that with me. But I'm also really grateful that I can see that change in them.
For folks that, you know, haven't had an opportunity to join an outfitter company like Your Smoke or one similar, is there any tips or advice that you would give first timers to ensure they have a good experience?
Yeah, the first thing that we do as outfitters is that we fit the saddle. That way they don't get very sore. And we make sure the stirrups are the right length, make sure they are on the right horse. Each one of our horses has an individual personality. And so we try to match personalities as well as weight and as well as experience. And when we do that, we end up with a good outcome because people enjoy their horses. Matter of fact, I have people that ride horses, have ridden our horses every year for several years. And at Christmas time, I always get bags of apples and carrots and stuff for their favorite horse, Lupin or Buck or whoever they were riding. And a Christmas card, of course, for that horse or that animal. And that really makes a lot of difference. And, you know, I went to Seattle once, took a truckload of horses out to Seattle to Salmon Lac. Actually, I went to Cle Elum first, and we unloaded there and drove our horses up the road to Salmon Lac, a trailhead on the Cascade Trail, and then rode into Lake Ivanhoe, made camp there, and I entertained some guests that they were the ones that built a funny-looking thing called the Space Needle.
No kidding.
Yeah, we took them in for about 5 days to Salmon Lac so they could fish and enjoy and relax. And when we come out, they took us on a ride to the Space Needle and put us in that glass elevator and sent us to the top. And we had dinner looking down at Seattle. And the interesting thing is one of those men, he actually built totem poles that surrounded the Space Needle originally. And I don't know whether they're still there or not. Cascade Pole Company built them.
What a small world, Smoke, because Salmon Lac and Cle Elum, they're only about 45 minutes away from where I live. And that area is just so beautiful. And I'm glad you got a chance to experience it. And then, you know, on the flip side, enjoying the outdoors, but then going to see the Space Needle and have a meal there. What an experience. I'm glad you were able to have that here in Washington.
Yeah, it was quite an experience. We really enjoyed it. And we've done a lot of those. I go to the Grand Canyon. I go to a lot of other places and teach a class. And then they take us somewhere to really see their particular area. So that works out real well.
You know, I wanted to ask you guys, because I've never been on a trip with a horse or riding a horse. I know that I have some friends that if they really push themselves, they can do 25, 30 miles in a day. On average, how many miles can you do on a horse?
You can do a lot of miles, but what we try to do is I try to leave camp at about 9 o'clock in the morning and get into camp at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we ride at 3 miles an hour. That's the speed of a walking horse on a trail. And we usually get there at about 2 o'clock, set up camp, and they can go fishing. They can do all kinds of things, relax that area. But one of the main things that we do is we interpret the country as we ride through it. I tell them, what about that cliff, or this is where somebody shot a big grizzly, or about the water, how clear it is and why it's clear that way. Our biggest draw, I think, is they go with an added benefit of the trip. Not only do they get to go somewhere and see new country, but they also get that country interpreted to them so that they understand the history and why it's there.
And your book mentions horseback rides, wildlife encounters, and, you know, wonderful campfire stories. And I got to share with you, so I didn't get into the outdoors until, well, after high school. And my buddies took me out, who were Eagle Scouts, took me out on my first camping experience. And I was very much a city slicker, I'll admit it, back then. I didn't know that bats, you know, flap around and hit your tent. So yeah. About, you know, close to midnight, I just keep hearing this bat fluttering around, and I think it's in the tent. And my buddies are getting ready to pass out, and I have to, you know, be like, hey guys, I think there's a bat in the tent. I've been hearing it for like the last 10 minutes. And I just get a pillow to the face and saying, go to sleep, Ivan. The bat's just hitting the outside of the tent. You don't have to worry about it. You know, I imagine when you bring people for the first time in those experiences, you have some funny stories as well as some challenges bringing new people into the outdoor space. Are there any stories that kind of stick out?
Yeah, I had lots of guests come from all over the country, and some of them come from Seattle. In fact, there is Bill Allen. He was the head of the Boeing Aircraft Company for a number of years, and I had him in the hills. And he enjoyed it very much. As a matter of fact, he started bringing his family. He'd bring his whole family on a trip, and he'd usually go in there for quite a few days, sometimes up to 20 to 30 days at a time. That was the only time he got a chance to spend time with his whole family where they didn't have to run off to some other place or answer phones or do computer work or any of that. It's all they had to do is enjoy each other around the campfire and have a good time fishing.
Oh, man, you've really touched a lot of lives, Smoke, by incorporating them into the outdoor space. And, you know, a lot of the times, especially in recent years, we're hearing about conserving these amazing places in the outdoors. How did your work as an outfitter shape your views on conservation?
Oh, boy, it shaped it right away. The first thing that I recognized, the first trip or two I started out with, I took in the University Foundation, which was 34 men. And I had about 107 head of stock with us. And that was too big a party. And it really did a lot of damage to some of that country. And we didn't actually get into the Bob Marshall. We got into the edge of it with the Forest Service at the Lincoln Scapegoat area. And I recognized that right away. And I said, hey, I got to cut back to about 8 or 10 people and a limited number of stock. We tried to load our stock to their optimum weight, which is about 200 pounds. A 1,000-pound animal can carry about 2,000 pounds or 200 pounds. And that way we controlled it. I recognized that I didn't want to come into a campsite that was all beat up. I wanted to come into a campsite and say, hey, you people are probably the first ones that have ever camped here. And that's what I wanted to try to teach them. And of course, by interpreting the country and selecting campsites that no one else used or went to, I was able to do that. And I think conservation of the wilderness and the backcountry is most important. I was instrumental in the Great Bear and in the Lincoln Scapegoat Wilderness, and also in the Maine Wilderness Act. I had something to do with that particular movement.
Can you describe a little bit about your involvement in advocating for the Wilderness Act?
I was on the Lincoln Scapegoat. We went to Great Falls. My employer, Tom Edwards, Whitetail Ranch, he said, come on, Smoke, put some good clothes on, and I'm going to take you over to Great Falls. So we went to Great Falls, and there was a minor hearing there on the land, and there was about 100, maybe 150 people there, and about 85 or 90 of them signed up to speak to the committee from Congress. I didn't know it, but Tom Edwards put my name on there. And I didn't know what to say. So he went on through, and finally Tom Edwards got on, and the next one was Smoke Elser. And I stepped up there and I said, I don't know what to say. I said, I'm going to be in the wilderness. I'm going to make my living in the wilderness. And I want you to protect it and give us as much wilderness as you possibly can. Thank you.
Now, Eva, you've had an amazing outdoor experiences, not just here domestically in the United States, but also in Europe. How has your view on conservation changed over the last couple of years?
That's an excellent question. So since I moved here, I think I realized more, and I think that happens to a lot of Germans, that there are not many wild places left in the world, and we don't really have true wilderness left in Europe. I mean, I traveled through Scotland and know Iceland. We have Iceland, obviously, has a lot of it still, but it has a different type of quality because it has not been developed in the first place. It didn't need to be renaturalized yet up here, right? So I think it was more urgent, or that sense of protecting and conserving what we have left, which is very little, is gotten more urgent, and it's more precious in that way. And I think that happens to a lot of Germans, right? I feel like I meet always Germans at those beautiful places, very far off the grid usually. When I run into somebody from a different country, it's always a German. And I think we do realize that, and we kind of seek that solitude maybe more, also because we have, you know, Montana is the same size as Germany, and we have 82 million people, 83 million now in Germany, and we have a little bit over a million in Montana. So can kind of show, it shows you maybe how it used to be like hundreds of years ago in Germany, maybe. So yeah, I do have that. I think I do have that development, or I got that through that development too. Conserve or be a little bit more active in the conservation community to keep the places wild that we have left, because they're really not many.
Yeah, no, I gotta agree with you guys. Now, these last couple questions, guys, are fun ones. And one thing that I'm really interested in, because you guys make some really great meals for folks that you're leading. And as a backpacker, I have to deal with dehydrated backpacking food to kind of keep my weight down. Do you guys have a favorite camp meal?
Yeah, we have some favorite meals. You know, when we serve our meals, we have a fresh vegetable salad at almost every meal. And one of our favorites, of course, is steak and mashed potatoes and gravy and a good tossed salad of some sort. Caesar salad or whatever. And that's what we really like to do. And, you know, we serve spaghetti, pork chops, you name it. The Norwegian meatballs is one of our first meals that my wife, she pre-cooks them, so I don't have so much work to do when I get to camp. Of course, breakfasts are always cakes, bacon and eggs, or hot ham and eggs, or something like that. Sometimes they're even biscuits and gravy. And with a horse, you're able to carry that much more gear and equipment. That's what we do. And of course, we have fresh fruit along with us every day. You can have a fruit of some sort, orange, apples, or pears, or whatever. Everything but bananas. Bananas are hard to pack, but we have fresh fruit on almost every day for our lunches.
Yeah, so I've been backpacking, and I still backpack, and I just love the fact that I can bring more food. It's actually when I pack a horse or a mule, and it's great for my kids too. So my favorite thing when I go horsepacking is that I have always a dessert, and not even a small one. I make brownies and bring them, or, you know, some sort of cake that I freeze and then it can be thawed out. So I really actually dwell on the fact that I celebrate the fact that I can bring dessert because it's such a special thing. But, you know, different to outfitters, when you do like recreational packing, you also try to keep everything fairly light in terms of dehydrated food. So we do bring that too. But I always make sure I bring extra food, because that's kind of the point of having a horse. You can bring those luxuries that you can't bring in your backpack.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll bring ice cream, for instance. On the second or third day, we'll have ice cream. And strawberry shortcake is another good dessert. Mm. I always have dessert. Every meal has a dessert. And we have that kind of thing. And we're able to do that with horses.
And it kind of adds, I really think it does add, not only because I have a sweet tooth, but I think it's also really adding to the experience, because it's not only, you know, you're not only surviving, you're actually really thriving and enjoying yourself more. And I think that kind of gives you sometimes a different view on what's happening around you in the wilderness. You look at that lake differently if you have a really full belly with strawberry shortcake.
Yeah, you bet.
Oh boy, yeah, you guys are making me hungry.
I know. We're recording this about dinner time. That probably doesn't help right now.
Now, I feel like a lot of day hikers, especially, and I'm interested in seeing if you guys have regular routine or ritual that you do on your trips. You know, for some, it's packing their favorite snack or drink. Others, it's maybe a moment of zen once they reach camp. And then, you know, for a lot of hikers, it's the meal afterwards. Is there a regular custom or routine that either of you guys do when you reach your destination or maybe when you make it back out?
Yeah. So for reaching a destination, what I do when I learned that from Smoke is I make sure, even with my students in my class, when I take them on a pack trip, but also with my family, that we take time apart to sit by ourselves somewhere by a creek or by a tree or wherever people want to sit and just sit there quietly and look around. I think that's extremely important. I do that on every trip, not necessarily every day, but definitely once people kind of arrive in wilderness. And I think it's an important, very, very important experience to really experience the hush of the land, to kind of quiet down and smell and see. I think that's important for doing the trip. And at the end, I always jump in the river because I am extremely, usually very hot, very dusty. And when I take care of my horses and everybody is taken care of, and there's a river close by, or if I have to drive by one, I will take that too. But I usually jump in.
Yeah. What I do is we take our guests, and it takes them about 3 days to slow down to 3 mile an hour. And then all of a sudden, you know, I collect all their watches. I don't let them carry a cell phone or anything else in the hills, and their watches, because from the time they reach the trailhead to start the trip, they're on my time, and I control the time real well for them. And one of the things I do is always is take my guests out and distribute them out across the country in a good place where they can sit against a ponderosa pine or sit alongside a river and listen to it flow, or even be in where there are some elk or some deer moving around. And I let them sit there for an hour and come around and visit with them each one at a time and find out what they heard and what they saw and what they realized. And for instance, Bill Allen from the Boeing Aircraft Company, I taught him to smell a ponderosa pine. And he smelled the bark on there, and it smells like vanilla, by the way. From that time on, every trip he made with us, he always would find a ponderosa and he'd run over and smell the bark on a ponderosa pine. And, you know, those are the things that he said that brought him down to earth, where he actually was putting his feet on the earth and moving through it.
You're both speaking right to me, because I love jumping into bodies of water when I make my destination. And we have some old grove ponderosa pines just a short drive away from me. And something about a ponderosa pine, the smell, especially in the morning or even on a hot summer day, is something else. And I'm glad that you were able to share that experience with Mr. Allen and have that probably be something that he did on a regular basis for the rest of his outdoor experiences.
I think it is.
You know, I'm interested in hearing this one, because you guys are able to pack a few more items with the horses and mules, but outside of your essential list that you already pack for all the trips, are there any luxury items that you're still packing? You know, for some it's a camera, for other ones it's a very specific treat or drink. Is there anything in particular that you guys kind of slip into your pack list that kind of falls outside of your essential list?
Well, what we do is we take a men and women's bathroom with us, so that we can set them up, and they have their own private bathroom virtually. So that works out very well. And yes, we do have some of them bring all kinds of alcohol with them, and some of them just bring pop with them. And sometimes we have to make iced tea for them, and that works out very well also. I'll never forget, you know, a guy hiked way up on the mountain and got some snow when we pulled into our camp at about 2 o'clock. He hiked up there, took him about 2 hours, and he got some snow in a bag and brought it down to camp. And on his way down, he ran across a bunch of mints, actually horse mints. And so at camp, we had our mint juleps sitting in the campfire.
I actually just thought about last year, I did a backpacking trip with the kids and then a pack trip. What I brought on the pack trip, and it didn't fit into my backpack was a little nerdy, but it was my animal sign and track book. It's pretty thick, and I love to bring it, and I'm always learning, of course. And so that is so cool, because I have my naturalist books with me, and I can go around, and if I see a sign, and I don't have Smoke with me, which we never rode on a trail together, so he was never able to actually show me anything on the trail. But every time I see something, I'm like, oh God, what is that? You know, and so I get my book out, and I read it. So that's great, because I have those saddlebags on the horse. I can just like grab it down, hold everybody, and then look it up. So that's a pretty heavy book, so I like to take that. I can't take that in my backpack.
Yeah, I like that. Now, we're still at the very beginning of 2024. Do you guys have any hiking or travel goals for this year?
So I'm not a goal person when it comes to hiking or riding. So I don't have bucket lists. I don't really believe in that. I like to see kind of what happens. And I know I'm aware I'm super lucky because the Marshall Wilderness is literally an hour away from me, so I can pack my stuff and go. But it also has proved to be the right thing to do in terms of climate change, in terms of changing weather and environments. You know, we don't know what's the snowpack going to be, which trail is blown out because an avalanche came down. Where are we going to have fires? You always have to be very flexible. So it serves me really well. So I don't really have kind of a bucket list or a goal of things where I want to go. I would just love to have a trip this year with my kids that we all enjoy with good weather, good grass for the horses, and my shortcake, strawberry shortcake by the lake. That's what I'm going for.
I like that.
I'm getting a little too old to go too far. I'm 90 years old right now, a little over 90. And what I like to do is I like to just take my horse and either ride or lead him out into the backcountry or into my own pasture and just watch him eat. Listen to that horse chew on the grass. That really satisfies me a lot.
You guys have definitely got me interested in looking up local outfitters here in Washington State and giving it a go. Because, yeah, it's definitely a different experience, but the way you guys describe it, it's so unique and it's almost magical.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been my life.
Now, that was it for the regular questions, guys. This last portion of the podcast is the this or that questions. I'm going to give you two outdoor topics, and you guys just choose which one you prefer out of the two. So when it comes to trails, do you prefer a steep incline or a steep decline?
Oh, a steep incline.
I enjoy getting up high.
And then this one's a tough one, but when it comes to trail features, waterfalls or summits?
Summits.
Summits, same here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I like to get up there where I can see all of the Bob Marshall in one view, which is very few places, but there are a couple in the Bob Marshall.
And then this one is about footwear. Do you guys still use traditional hiking boots in the outdoors, or have you guys transitioned to trail runners?
Well, that one I have to answer because I would use neither. Because if I ride my horse, I want to make sure I have a heel. And so I have boots that I can ride in that have a heel, but I can also walk well in. Because sometimes, especially when I go downhill, I hike my horse. Different than smoke, but that's what I like to do. So when I hike, though, with a backpack, I usually like my hiking boots because I like that support in my ankles. But I would never use those boots on riding my horse.
I don't even have a pair of hiking boots. The only pair I have... three pair of cowboy boots, and that's it. I don't wear any other kind. I've never worn any other kind.
This is another trail system question, but do you guys prefer a loop trail or an out and back trail?
Loop.
Yeah, I like, and we just cross the trail. We don't like to make any loops at all. We cross the trail and come out at another trailhead. I pick up another group of guests and cut across and go out, come out the west side and turn around and come out on the southeast side. So I like to go and see new country. Fortunately, I know what's going to be around most turns, but I like to go around the turn in the trail where I don't know what's going to be there. I don't know what it's going to look like. I like that part of it. And I think my guests do too.
And this one's a tough one, but do you prefer catching sunsets or sunrises?
Ooh, sunrises.
Yeah, sunrises. I like them both. Sunrise is very good, but a sunset means that we're starting to light the campfire. And we're going to get to know everybody in our party and hear a little bit from all of them about what they're doing and why they're there. So a sunset sometimes is a very important part for me.
And then another equally hard one. Do you guys prefer spring wildflowers or fall colors?
Whoa, that's difficult.
Yeah.
That's very difficult. I don't know if I can choose one of them. That's pretty tough. I do like fall colors because it also means it's my birthday. So I do like that. So I'm impartial. But I've seen so many beautiful wildflowers that I would not want to pick one or the other, really. Yeah, I think I would say both. I don't think I can choose one.
Yeah, I like spring flowers real well. And it's kind of interesting because then I get to see the young animals, the young deer and the calf elk and the bears with two cubs. And that kind of thing. So I like the spring real well, but I also like the fall colors. We take a couple of trips into a game reserve where you're not allowed to shoot anything. And we're about the only ones in that area. And it's really kind of neat because I see all the aspen turning yellow. And then right in behind the aspen will be a big old bull elk and he'll be bugling it to us. all partner all night.
And then the last one is, when you guys do make it to camp, and I know, Eva, you've already answered this, but when you guys do make it to camp or you guys come across a body of water, do you guys jump in or stay dry? And by jumping in, it could be just, you know, putting your feet in there, touching it with your hands.
Yeah, we that's the only way we get a shower, you know. That's our bathtub. So we jump into the water. But, you know, one of the other things we do is as soon as we get camp set up pretty well, my crew comes right over to the kitchen, and I always have cookies and Kool-Aid. So we have cookies and Kool-Aid while we sit and enjoy what we've experienced that day. So that's what we usually do. And we save the jumping into the water when it's high noon and we have a layover day and the sun's really nice and bright. That's the time to really jump in.
I like that. Well, that was it for the this or that questions, guys. The book Hush of the Land, A Lifetime in the Bob Marshall Wilderness came out at the beginning of March, and folks can pick it up both online and at their local bookstores. Can you guys share a little bit about why nature lovers and outdoor enthusiasts should pick up this book this spring season?
Well, it kind of explains a lifetime in the Bob Marshall, and that means that not only did I hit fall day, but I also hit summer hot days, and I also hit early spring, and I also hit sometimes when we were walking through the snow, riding our horses through the snow. So I think that's what might interest most everybody. And there are stories in there that I haven't been chased by a mountain lion, but I sure heard a mountain lion real close to me. And I also have come out of the hills at the end of the season and had to leave. Howard Copenhaver and I had to leave his dog Cheese because his dog said, "No, my life is pretty well over. I'm going to stay where I like it." So he stayed in the wilderness, and we had to come out because it was about 2 foot of snow, and it was the end of the hunting season. And Cheese came part of the way, turned around, went back to camp, and that's where he's still there.
I think it's a book that for everybody who might not be able to go on a pack trip, yeah, or not, definitely not on a pack trip with smoke, can read that book and go on a pack trip. So you don't have to spend a whole lot of money and go on a horse. I think you can also just sit down and read and kind of figure out if that's something for you to try and then go and do it. And it teaches you along the way lots of the history. I hope it does what smoke did on his trips, interpret the country for you while you ride down the trail. Gives you lots of history, lots of context of the Bob Marshall Wilderness and the Bitterroot Mountains. And I hope it just becomes a book that people take on every hiking trip or packing trip, but in particular when they visit the Bob Marshall.
Yeah, the guests are right behind me in this book. As I travel down the trail, they're right behind me. I'm telling them about the country as I see it and as they see it. So you don't have to really go anywhere. You can read the book and follow me, be on the trail with me.
And just maybe one thing to add. So you can get the book anywhere where you buy books, your favorite bookstore. And we're so lucky. We have a lot of great bookstores here in Missoula. And one of them, Fact and Fiction, they offer signed copies. So you can actually order them online, or you can call in and order it and we can sign it for you and they will mail it to your door. So that's a great way if you want a personalized or signed copy.
Thanks, Eva, for sharing that. I'll be sure to share that link in the episode show notes so people can order it through them and get a signed copy. Thank you so much, both Smoke, Eva, for joining me on the podcast. And you guys nailed it right on the head, because I caught myself daydreaming while reading this book about like how my experience would be if I joined an outfitter and got to participate in some of these long treks that you guys did. And it's definitely something that's intrigued me, and I'm hoping to be able to explore that in the next couple of years. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for
your great questions and for having us.
You bet.
And that brings us to the end of this episode alongside Smoke Elser and Eva Maria Maggi. We extend a heartfelt thanks to them for coming on the podcast. Make sure to stay connected and follow them on Instagram at Hush of the Land. And don't forget to check out the episode show notes for more. We have an incredible lineup of episodes planned throughout the spring months, and we can't wait to share them with you. New episodes will be dropping every Monday with occasional bonus episodes on Fridays. To ensure you never miss out on those thrilling tales, remember to hit that like and subscribe button. Your support means the world to us. Don't forget to join our vibrant community on Instagram at Hikes and Mikes. We'll be sharing episode visuals, my own personal hiking content, and so much more. Let's stay connected and continue to inspire each other on this remarkable journey. As we bid farewell, remember to tread those happy trails, embrace the great outdoors, and keep the spirit of adventure alive. Until next time, my fellow explorers, happy hiking. This episode's music was created by Ketsa. Follow him on Instagram at Ketsa Music. This episode is brought to you by Flip Socks. Whether you're on the trail, on the job, or in the yard, Flip Socks will keep Mother Nature out of your boots with their innovative nylon sleeve. You no longer need to worry about any annoying debris getting trapped in your boots during your hikes. Simply flip down the nylon sleeve over any boot to prevent Mother Nature from finding its way inside, keeping your feet comfortable all day long. To get your first pair, visit flipsockswithaz.com and enter promo code HikesMikes10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. And for listeners who use the promo code at checkout, I'll be donating 100% of the Season 2 promo code proceeds to Big City Mountaineers, who provide transformative experiences through connections to nature that strengthen life skills and build community for youth and disinvested communities across the nation. So if you're tired of bits and pieces of the trail finding its way into your hiking boots, pick up a pair of Flip Socks today with the promo code HikesMikes10 to get 10% off. For website and promo code, see the episode description.